These tapes are produced in the spirit of AA's 12th step to carry the message. Members of the fellowship should bear in mind AA's 11th tradition regarding anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films and the use of these tapes. Anonymity to this extent is actually the practice of genuine humility. We assure that humility, expressed by anonymity, is the greatest safeguard that AA could ever have.
Oh, Joe and Charlie, we'll give them a big welcome.
Hello, everyone. My name is Joe, and I know I don't look like it, but I'm an alcoholic. And it's truly by God's grace and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I found in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sober today, and for that I'm very, very thankful. And I'd like to read the preamble, please. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and to help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And I want, before I forget it, I want to thank the committee for inviting me to come to Boca Raton, the mouth of the rat, what I understand. And I'm glad to be here, and it's a real honor for them to invite me, and I feel real privileged. And I'm very grateful also that you're here, because I can tell you one thing, it'd be a lousy meeting if I was the only one here this morning or this afternoon. So thank you for coming. I rushed out there a while ago. I didn't notice the time. I went to the restroom, and this lady tapped me on the shoulder. She said, "Oh, are you Joe, one of the Joes of Joe and Charlie?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "Do you ever get nervous at one of these things?" And I said, "No, not really." She said, "Oh, really?" She said, "You're in the ladies' restroom." So I'll settle down here in a minute, I hope. Now I'll introduce you to my friend, Charlie.
Hi, everybody. My name is Charlie Farman. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of the power that I found through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found necessary to take a drink for 11,516 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. It's great to be back in Southern Florida again. I have to say Southern Florida because I can't always remember which town we're in anymore. Boca Raton or Fort Lauderdale or Pompano Beach or wherever. So it's just Southern Florida. That'll be safe. We always like to say as we start one of these things that none of us up here consider ourselves to be the gurus of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't consider ourselves to be the experts on anything at all. We're just three old drunks, met together several years ago, found we had a mutual interest in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. We studied it together for quite some time. Hopefully, we've learned a few things about it. And those few things we've learned about it, we just love to be able to share them with other people. We do not attempt to speak for AA as a whole, and you're most certainly free to agree or disagree with anything that we say throughout the entire weekend. In fact, if you hear us saying things that can't be reconciled with what's in the Big Book, we suggest you don't pay any attention to those things at all, and we'll do our best to keep our comments on the Big Book itself. We also realize that the book tells us we are meant to be joyous, happy, and free. And we love to have fun. We love to laugh. We love to cut up. We love to tell jokes. From time to time, we'll probably stop whatever we're doing, tell a little joke, get a little humor started, and if we tell one and it isn't funny, go ahead and laugh anyhow. It'll make you feel better, make the one next to you feel better, make us feel better too. We are fully and completely aware of the fact that the mind will only absorb about what the rear end will stand, And if you look at your program, you're going to notice that some of these sessions are going to be quite long. And if you feel the need to get up and move around during one of these sessions, please feel free to do so. That's not going to bother us at all. If you feel the need to go outside, smoke a cigarette, get a cup of coffee, whatever, please feel free to do that. If you feel the need to go get rid of a cup of coffee during one of these sessions, don't sit there and suffer in silence. Go right ahead. It's not going to bother us at all. And I think if we can approach this entire weekend with those ideas in mind, that not only are we going to try to learn something about our program and about our book, but we're going to do our best to have a good time while we're doing it, then we're all in for a good, fun weekend. I know that I'm going to enjoy it, and my sincere hope is that everybody in here leaves here being able to say, we've had a good, fun, enjoyable weekend. I'd like to introduce you to my friend Joe on the right here, Joe.
My name is Joe, and I'm a real alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
Through God's grace and because this program works one day at a time in my life, I've never found it necessary to take a drink since the 10th of March, 1962. With this, I'm extremely grateful. Unlike Charlie, it's good to be here. You at this point tell a little bit about, you know, what this is all about, as Charlie said, so you can be comfortable with what we're about to do. I had been in the program for about 8 years, and I began to work with alcoholics, and I felt a need to learn more about the program, so I began to study the book. At that time, you know, we had sponsorship, but not book studies and meetings and such. Some of the old-timers said we didn't need to study the book. I thought maybe they're right. Maybe I'm doing something wrong here. I don't want to do anything sacrilegious. But I persisted in trying to study the book and trying to talk to somebody about it. But, you know, it was kind of funny. There's nobody to talk to. Everybody just isolates you. In fact, when they saw me coming, they'd run. And it was in 1973, I believe it was, that I met Charlie. I introduced him at an Al-Anon conference of all places. We met at Al-Anon conference. And he and his wife were going to speak there. And after the meeting, I came up and got involved with him and started talking about the big book. And he was real first person I ever seen in 2 years that was interested. I couldn't let this guy get away, so we made a beginning right there that night, I think. And we would meet at different places and study the book together and talk about the book. Other people found out what we were doing, and they wanted to sit in. And Joe, that's when we met Joe, in the first early days of the big book. He was there originally. Two people in the room. When look at the room today, it was about five or six people sitting around on beds in somebody's bedroom with their books. And this is the way it got started. It was taped and sent out, and Chow and I began to go to numerous places and be asked to put it on for the weekend. It was during this time that we met Wesley on one of these occasions. And Wesley was a great part of the big book, because he was the one that, you know, he could really get things done. Wesley walked up to the table, and we had this first session, and it was in Omaha, I believe, or somewhere up there in Iowa, somewhere in that part of the country. And the session had just started, and he was going to speak Saturday night. He was sitting there listening to it. He was a great student of the book. He had studied the book for many years before Charlie and I even come along. But he studied by himself, and I think one of the greatest secrets that John and I had was two different minds working together. And he looked at us and said, I remember him saying something about...
He said, who in the hell are you, and where in the hell did you come from? He said, I've been waiting to hear this for 25 years.
Yeah. And we become instant friends over the book. It was in 1980 when Wesley pulled his little deal down in New Orleans. We'd been going a few places, but Wesley wanted a way to get the big book study out to people. So he had a luncheon and invited 1,500 people to this luncheon. He seated them all so he knew where each one was seated. And he gave away 100 sets of these tapes as door prizes. Now, the people thought they won them, but they didn't win them. Wesley had already picked them out. And so the tapes went back to every major city, major state, and overseas. It went all over the world, I guess. And our child and I's lives have never been the same since Wesley did that. So the Big Book Study has been broad, has been spread all over the country, really all over the world. It has helped, we hope, to bring Alcoholics Anonymous back to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I think if we did that one thing to get us back on track to what we were, back to the program rather than just the fellowship, that this has been a great journey. So it's good to be here for the same thing today. And what we're trying to do, we're not talking about the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to be talking about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Okay, and to bring us up to date on where we are now and why we got three people up here, about 11 years ago, back in 1990, this Joe decided he wanted to slow down a little bit. He said, "Charlie, we're traveling too much. We're doing too many big book studies. I need to stay home once in a while." Well, I wasn't quite ready to slow down. I said, "Okay, we'll do that. But in the meantime, I'm going to talk to Joe McCoy from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and see if Joe would be willing to travel and do the big book study." So I called Joe. He had just come out of his term as the delegate from the General Service Conference for Oklahoma. And Joe had been with us for years anyhow. And Joe said, yeah, he would be glad to. So Joe started coming in with me, and we'd travel and do big book studies together. So he's been doing them with us now for about 11 years.
Now, what I said was, I wouldn't be glad to. What I said was, oh. Because years ago, there was a guy named Tony Vargas who was number three. He met with Charlie and Joe, and they met the three of them together. And one day I was at a conference, this was 1974, and I was walking down the hallway minding my own business. And Tony said, "Hey, Joe, would you like to go listen to these guys talk about the Big Book?" And I said, "Well, sure. Wasn't doing anything anyhow." So I made a right-hand turn and went into those rooms, and we sat down there, and my life changed. And I am today in AA the result of what Charlie and Joe have taught me. So if you don't like me, blame it on them.
Now, only one time before have we tried this with all three of us together out in California, and it worked out pretty good. So we're not sure how it's going to work out this time, but we're going to have a lot of fun while we're doing it anyhow, one way or the other. I'm going to try to be the moderator, and I'm going to try to let them do most of the talking, and you know how difficult that is for me to do. So we have no idea what's going to happen, but we're going to have fun while we're doing it, that's for sure. If we're going to talk about the Big Book, we need to look at a little bit of the history behind it. Now, John's already done a good job in history, but there's some of it we would like to look at to kind of bring us up to date and get some ideas of the idea of the first 100 people when they put this thing together. And if we can look at a little bit of that history, then I think it's going to make it a lot easier to understand the Big Book itself as we go through it. So to do that, we'd like to go directly to the Big Book, to the foreword to the second edition, Roman numeral 15, and let's go to the last paragraph on that page, and we'll start there. I wish their names were not both Joe, because it makes it more difficult. So I'm going to have to say Joe left and Joe right as I moderate. So I'm going to start with Joe left. Joe?
Yeah, there's a little, a little formula that Bill has used and through all of his writings, and this is really, it was really, really important to me to unlock Bill's writings. Bill will do three things he always does in everything that he writes, so keep this in mind when you're reading things about that Bill wrote. He will tell you what the problem is. He will give you a solution to that problem. And then he will give you a practical program of action to implement the solution that he just described.
He does that over and over and over and over. So now at the bottom of page, Roman numeral page 15, which is XV, for those of us, which I didn't know what Roman numerals were when I got here, it said the spark that was to flare in the first AA group was struck at Akron, Ohio on June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician.
And we know that New York stockbroker to be this fellow named Bill Wilson. I think we're treating Bill pretty good when we call him a New York stockbroker. He really wasn't. He was a New York City stock speculator. He made his living out of selling fast-talking to slow-thinking people. We don't want to take anything away from Bill. He was a great man. But we all need to realize that Bill Wilson was a real alcoholic, just like all the rest of us. The same kind of thoughts, the same drives, the same desires, just like everybody else in AA. The Akron physician was this fellow named Dr. Bob Smith.
Now, 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford groups of that day.
Later on, as we get into Bill's story, we're going to see that this alcoholic friend turned out to be a fellow named Ebbie Thatcher. And Ebbie Thatcher was an old drinking buddy of Bill's. They went to school together. And Ebbie brought to Bill what turned out to be two vital pieces of information. He sat down with Bill in Bill's kitchen and he said, "Bill, people like you and I, who have become absolutely powerless over alcohol, if we're going to recover from that condition, we're going to have the aid of a power greater than human power." He said, "We've already tried all the hospitals, all the doctors, and etc., and we're going to have the aid of a power greater than human power." And when he told him that, he presented Bill with a solution to alcoholism. He said, "I've been attending meetings with a group of people called the Oxford Groupers. And they told me if I would follow a practical program of action, that I would have a spiritual experience. And during that spiritual experience, I would find the power greater than human power." So he said, "The solution to our problem is the spiritual experience, the finding of the power." And he also outlined for Bill the practical program of action that the Oxford group had given him to be able to have the spiritual experience. And he said, "Look at me, Bill." He said, "I've been sober for 2 months." And this made a great impression on Bill Wilson, because he knew Ebbie. He knew how Ebbie drank. And he knew that if Ebbie had been staying sober for a period of 2 months, some power greater than human power had to be working in Ebbie's life. So Ebbie really gave Bill two things. He gave him the solution to alcoholism as the vital spiritual experience during which we find the power greater than human power. He gave him the practical program of action necessary to find that power. So two things that Bill had to know came to Bill from Ebbie through the Oxford groups.
He said he had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, who is now kind of no less of the medical saint by AA members and whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. From this doctor, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism.
A little later on, we're going to see it also in Bill's story, where Bill was placed in the town's hospital as far back as the summer of 1933, and he's withdrawn from alcohol by Dr. Silkworth. And after he came off of the booze and he was able to think and hear and listen a little bit, Dr. Silkworth sat down with him in the summer of 1933 and explained to him his ideas about this thing called alcoholism. He said, "Bill, I do not believe that alcoholism is a matter of willpower. I do not believe it's a matter of moral character. And I don't think sin's got anything to do with it." He said, "I believe people like you are suffering from an illness." And he said, "It's a very peculiar illness. It seems to be a twofold illness, an illness of the mind as well as an illness of the body." And he said, "I really believe that people like you have developed what we refer to as an allergy to alcohol." He said, "It seems as though any time you put any alcohol whatsoever into your system, it produces an actual physical craving, which makes it virtually impossible for you to stop drinking after you have once started." And he said that actual physical craving is an abnormal reaction to alcohol. And he said because of that, you'll never be able to safely drink alcohol again as long as you live. But he said that's only half of your problem. He said the other half of your problem is I also believe that you have developed what we call an obsession of the mind. And he said an obsession of the mind is an idea that overcomes all ideas to the contrary. And it really doesn't make any difference how badly you want to stop drinking. From time to time, your mind's going to tell you that it's okay to drink. And believing that it'll be different this time. Believing that this time you can just have a couple of drinks and everything will be okay. You'll go ahead and take the drink. The drink will trigger the allergy and you'll end up drunk every time. He said you could no longer stay sober because of the obsession of the mind. And he said, if you can't safely drink because of the body, the allergy, if you can't stay sober because of the mind, the obsession, then you become absolutely powerless over alcohol. And for the first time in his life, Bill understood what his problem was. You see, he always thought it was willpower. He thought it was moral character. He thought it was sin. Why should he not? That's what everybody had told him up until that time. But when Silkworth explained to him in the summer of 1933, the exact nature of the illness, for the first time, Bill understood the problem. We also know that he felt that self-knowledge would fix it, and now that he knew what's wrong with him, he wouldn't have to drink anymore. He got drunk shortly thereafter. Drank again until the summer of 1934. Back in the town's hospital again. This time, Dr. Silkworth pronounced him incurable, period. So knowing the problem was not the solution to it. Knowing the problem was not the answer. It is only when Ebby visited with him, gave him the solution to that problem, gave him the program of action necessary to find that solution, that Bill was able to recover from alcoholism. So he had to know three things. Number one, what is the problem? Number two, what is the solution? And number three, what's the program of action necessary to bring about that solution? Then he could recover from alcoholism.
Ebby began to take Bill to these Oxford group meetings. And the book says that though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford groups, he was convinced of the need of moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restitution to those harmed, helpless to others, and the necessity of and belief in and dependence upon God, which were the tenets of the Oxford group, which later on Bill expanded those into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Joe, too.
Okay, prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on a theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic. But he had only succeeded in keeping sober himself. The broker had gone to Akron on a business venture which had collapsed. This time, 6 months after Bill's recovery in December 1934, through the spring of that year up until May, he had been working with a lot of alcoholics trying to help them, trying to carry them, get them to do what he had done. Mainly the reason he was failing, he was trying to give everybody to take the program of the Oxford groups, which started out basically with turn your life a little care to God. Bill was going around preaching to every drunk he could find, and no one paid any attention to him. He hadn't learned the rhythm of the steps yet. He hadn't really got it together yet. One day he was back in the town's hospital, visiting a drunk there, talking to one. Doc Silver had allowed him to come in and talk to them. And he was visiting with Doc Silver in the hallway. It wasn't a formal meeting. And he said, Doctor, I can't get anybody to help pay any attention to what I tell them. And these drunks won't do nothing I tell them. I don't know if I'm wrong. I'm failing with all of them. He said, Bill, I think you're making a mistake. I think you should first tell them what I told you. First what the problem is. If you can get there, then it will get their attention. Then maybe they'll buy into your solution. And then they will take your little program of action. This is a very important meeting. don't know, it seemed like the secrets of seeds of AA just barely were sown here in these little meetings. The day, we say maybe AA began the day Abby walked into Bill's kitchen, where the problem met the solution and the program of recovery. Or maybe when Dr. Silkworth gave this little idea to Bill. Or the very next alcoholic Bill talked to happened to be Dr. Bob in Akron. He went there on a business trip, which failed.
He said to Bill, Bill, every alcoholic I know has two questions. Number one, why can't I drink like I used to without getting drunk all the time? And number two, why can't I quit drinking now that I want to quit? And he said, if you will explain to them the exact nature of the illness, as I explained it to you, talk to them about the physical allergy, talk to them about the obsession of the mind, you will get their attention. And he said, after you get their attention, then you can talk to them about spirituality. But he said, the first thing they got to know is what's wrong with them. And we don't think it's by accident. The very next person Bill talked to happened to be Dr. Bob in Akron.
The broker had gone to Akron on a business venture which had failed, collapsed, leaving him in great fear that he might start drinking again. He suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. That alcoholic turned out to be the Akron physician. And Dr. Bob was a physician. He had read everything he could find on alcoholism, trying to find his answer in the medical field. He had talked to a lot of great people, but he never received, he couldn't get no hint of what was going on with him. So the physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means. He was in the Oxford group himself. He had been in that 2 years. Bill had just been in 6 months. So he knew what the Oxford Group program was. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and his hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady, which he willed as he never before was able to muster.
I think this is a very, very important point. You know, I always wondered for years, how did this old con and manipulating New York City stockbroker sit down with this well-trained physician and explain to the physician what was wrong with him? Normally the physician would have said, well, who in the hell are you to be telling me? But Bill did something here he had never done before. In the prior 6 months that he had tried to work with people, he always talked to them about spirituality. He couldn't talk to Dr. Bob about spirituality because Dr. Bob knew more about it than Bill did. So what Bill did, he said, let me tell you about my drinking. And rather than talk about Dr. Bob's drinking, Bill began to relate his own story, his own experiences with alcohol. And as he began to talk about the many, 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 many times that he stopped off in the speakeasy, was just going to have a drink or two. He said, then something would happen and I would be unable to stop drinking and I would end up drunk and sick every time. Dr. Bob said, my God, man, that's what's been happening to me. And Bill said, well, another doctor in New York City explain to me that this is a physical allergy of the body, an abnormal reaction to alcohol, that our bodies are different when it comes to alcohol. He continued to talk about the many, many times he'd sworn off drinking. He said, I've got a tremendous amount of willpower. I've always been able to do anything I wanted to do based on willpower. But he said, I might swear off drinking one day in the morning, and by afternoon I found myself in a bar somewhere drunk. Dr. Bob said, my God, man, that's what's been happening to me. And Bill said, well, this same little doctor explained to me that this is an obsession of the mind. And he explained to me that because of the physical allergy, because of the obsession of the mind, that I've become absolutely powerless over alcohol. Bill, through the sharing of his story, helped Dr. Bob see what his problem was. You see, Dr. Bob thought it was willpower. He thought it was moral character. He thought it was sin. Why should he not? That's what everybody had told him up until that time. But through the sharing of Bill's story, Dr. Bob was able to see his own problem. Then he began to apply the solution, the practical program of action, and he had his spiritual experience and he recovered from alcoholism. Now the book says, he sobered never to drink again after the moment of his death in 1950. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery, two of the things that our whole society's been built upon. One alcoholic sharing his story, his or her story, with another alcoholic can affect that other alcoholic as no non-alcoholic can. You know, most of the people that are out there drinking today that are alcoholic, they don't know they're alcoholic. They think their problem is willpower, moral character, and sin. Why should they not? That's what everybody's telling them. The information that we have for the new alcoholic is something that they have never heard before. And as we talk about our own allergy of the body, we talk about our own obsession of the mind, then the new alcoholic coming in AA says, hey, that's what's wrong with me. That's been happening with me for years. We've got information for him that nobody else has got. Also, Bill Wilson, through sharing with Dr. Bob, managed to stay sober. You see, he didn't go to Dr. Bob to sober up Dr. Bob. He went there because he was about to get drunk. And he made a series of phone calls and found another drunk to talk to, and by golly, Bill stayed sober. So the two things that our whole fellowship has been built upon, they was determined that night, one alcoholic sharing with another could affect another alcoholic as no other alcoholic could. Also, it was necessary for Bill's own sobriety. Joe?
Bill and Bob were talking one night, and Bob said, Bill, if we're going to do this thing, we better get busy. He said, what do you mean get busy? He said, well, you said helping other people to help us stay sober. Let's get busy helping some drunks. And Bill said, well, I don't know any drunks. I'm from New York, of course. I'm not from Akron. Maybe, do you know any? He said, no, I don't know any. He said, let's call that hospital down there and talk to that head nurse. Maybe she'll know some drunks that we can work with. So he called up the head nurse down to the Akron City Hospital and told that lady that he had an expert on alcoholism from New York and seemed to have a solution for alcoholism. Do you have any drunks there? And the lady said, well, Dr. Bob, have you tried this on yourself? She knew that he was a drunk. He said, yes, I have. And so he said, yeah, we've got a fella here. We got him in the ward down there, locked on his bed. He said, won't let him up. He's blacked the eyes of a couple of the nurses, and we've got him shut down. So we'll put him in a private room, and we'll be down in the morning to talk to him. So they put him in a private room. Now, he said, hence the two men set to work almost frankly with alcoholics arriving in the ward of an Akron City hospital. Those of you who are old enough to remember wards in the hospital, they were generally at the end of a hall, and generally just put screens around you. You couldn't afford a private room or a semi-private room or any room, so they put you at the end of the hall, and they call it a ward. And if it looked like you were going to die, they would take you off the ward and put you in a private room. So they put this fella in a private room. I'm sure he thought, hell, I'm going to die, so they put me in here. So he said their very first case, a desperate one, recovered immediately and became AA number 3. He never had another drink. This guy was a lawyer named Bill Dotson. And here was Bill and Bob, who know two things. One is that they knew that they were alcoholics. They knew because of Dr. Silkworth's opinion. They knew that they had a physical allergy and obsession of the mind. And they also knew that there was a solution for this. They knew three things. And they sat down there with Bill Dotson, the lawyer, and they began to talk to Bill Dotson, not about Bill Dotson's drinking. They were talking about their own drinking. They were showing through their own experience how this obsession of the mind worked and how the physical allergy worked. And Bill Dotson began to identify with them and identify. Yes, I'm like that. I'm just like that. You fellows really know what you're talking about. That was the effect they had on Bill Dotson. A couple of days later, his wife showed up and said, get my clothes. I'm getting out of here, and I'm going to go with these two guys and do what they did. And he left, and we know that he never had another drink. But you see, the secret was that they didn't talk to Bill Dotson about Bill Dotson drinking. They talked about their own. So now we have three people who know the three things. They know about the physical allergy, the obsession of the mind, and they know about the solution.
And they know the program of action. He said this work at Akron continued through the summer of 1935. There were many failures, but there was an occasional heartening success. And we go back and look at that time, and we've got to realize in the summer of 1935, they knew very little about what they were talking about. They would try one thing, and if it worked, they would retain it. They would try something else. If it didn't work, they would discard it. You know, one of Dr. Bob's favorite things during that summer of 1935 was to fill the newcomer up with sauerkraut juice and honey, mixed with honey. The sauerkraut juice had the vitamins in it necessary for the body. The honey would make it where he could actually drink the damn stuff. They tried that and many other things through the summer of 1935. And every once in a while, one of these guys would fall over dead. I can almost see Bill turn to Bob and say, "Oh, shit, let's don't do that again." As we look back at that period of time, we always give credit to Bill and Bob and the first 100, and rightfully we should. But I think we also need to give some credit to those that they failed with. They probably learned more from the failures than they did from the successes during that summer. Now, as that summer began to end, fall started to approach. Bill began to say, "Look, I've been here as long as I can. I need to go back to New York City. I need to get back to work. I need to go back where my wife is and get back in business." So when the broker returned to New York in the fall of 1935, the first AA group had actually been formed, though no one realized it at that time. There was no AA in the summer of 1935. Everybody was a member of the Oxford group. Now, from the very beginning, though, there was trouble between the alcoholics and the regular Oxford groupers. The Oxford groupers really were not into the business of sobering up drunks. They were more interested in helping the more elite members of society overcome their problems, whatever they might be. Then maybe they could help the mayor of the city, maybe the governor of the state, maybe the president of the country. Maybe they could help people worldwide. The drunks were not very interested in that kind of stuff. The Oxford groupers were having trouble with these drunks. The drunks would come to the meetings and they would do a little cursing. They would tell dirty jokes. They drank coffee and spilled it on the carpets. You know, and the Oxford groupers wasn't too crazy about them. The drunks were not too crazy about the Oxford groupers. The Oxford groupers had a thing they called the four absolutes, where you were to practice absolute love, absolute purity, absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness. And the drunks were having a hard time being absolute anything except drunks. So to separate themselves from the regular Oxford groupers, they called themselves the drunk squad of the Oxford group. That's what Bill left behind him when he went back to New York City. No AA, the drunk squad of the Oxford group. Joe?
A second small group probably took shape in New York before 1937 started with 30 in Cleveland. Now, when Bill went back to New York, he began to practice what he learned in Akron. You know, he didn't try to get people to force them into the program of recovery. That's what he had failed with. He started telling them what their problem was, then their solution, then giving them the program of recovery. People started getting sober in New York. There were scattered alcoholics who had picked up the basic ideas in Akron and New York who were trying to form groups in other cities. By late 1937, the number of members having substantial sobriety time behind them was sufficient to convince the membership that a new light had entered the dark world of the alcoholic. It was time now that the struggling group thought to place their message and unique experience before the world. Now, this was 1937, and Bill, they say, was back in Akron again, and he was visiting while he was there on the same money deal trying to put this thing together, which never did work. He was visiting with Dr. Bob, and they were counting heads, and there were almost 40 people sober. And they decided, you know, what could they do? This might be some vital information for alcoholics. How could they get this out to other people? They didn't want to do it themselves, but they had a meeting. They called a meeting of all the Oxford group people in Akron, some alcoholics, some non-alcoholics. There were 18 people there at that meeting that night. And they decided to do three things. First, they decided the thing to do was build a chain of hospitals across the United States to treat alcoholics.
Dr. Bob was probably going to be the head doctor, too.
Now, here they are doing depression. Ain't nobody got a dime, and they're going to build a chain of hospitals. They ain't even got a job. Secondly, they're going to hire missionaries to carry this message.
Bill was probably going to be the head missionary, I imagine.
And third, the third thing they did decide was to write a book. They decided to write a book to so they could get this message out to people, and to secure and preserve the message that they had at that time, which was just a word of mouth message. Now you know what a word of mouth message is amongst much alcoholics. It's bad enough when you write it down; they still destroy it. <You know. laughs> But anyway. So Bill, this is when Bill decided to write the book. And Bill's going to be the principal author. We'll talk about that later on, about the job of writing it, beginning 1937. Okay. And Determination bore fruit in the spring of 1939 by the publishing of this volume. Started in 39, 2 years later, the book was finished in April 1939. Okay. Membership had reached 100 men and women. The society, the fledgling society, which had been nameless. They were Oxford groupers and drunk squads of the Oxford group and different things by that time. They were nameless. Now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of its own book.
Okay. 1939. The first Alcoholics Anonymous that the world ever saw was a book titled Alcoholics Anonymous. The little society, which had been called the drunk squads of the Oxford groups, now began to call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of this book. So in 1939, the same as we do today, we had two Alcoholics Anonymouses. We had a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, which contained the story of how the first 100 men and women had recovered from alcoholism. Then we had a society called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of this book. Now, naturally, the members of the society had used the program in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. So in 1939, there was no difference between the program in the book Alcoholics Anonymous and the program in the society, Alcoholics Anonymous. They were both identically the same, Joe.
Yeah, let's go to Roman numeral page 20. And we're going to see some of the success they had when the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous was practicing the principles in the book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and some of the success that they had. He said, while the internal difficulties of our adolescent period were being ironed out, public acceptance of AA grew by leaps and bounds. For this, there were two principal reasons: the large number of recoveries and reunited homes. Sometimes we forget that idea about reunited homes in AA. Thank God for Al-Anon. Now, these made their impressions everywhere. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sobered once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Other thousands came to a few AA meetings and first decided they didn't want the program. But great numbers of these, about two out of three, began to return as time passed. If my math is correct, that's 75% of those people who came and really tried stayed sober. In my area, I don't know about yours, we can't even fantasize about 75%. Can't even talk about 50. Can't even brag about 25. And I think the reason for that is because the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, starting in about 1970, got away from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that was in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and we began to lay that program down and think, well, I'm going to meetings. I can stay sober just going to meetings. And a lot of people started staying sober just going to meetings. You see people today who have to go to a meeting once or twice or three times a day. Which is nothing wrong with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It helped me stay sober until I could find the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But ultimately, I was introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in the book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I began to stay sober. You know, there's a little pamphlet in AA. It's called Problems Other Than Alcohol, written by Bill Wilson in 1955. And he saw these problems, foresaw these problems in Alcoholics Anonymous. And a little statement on page 4 of that little pamphlet, the smaller one, he said, the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, the purpose of an AA group.
The sole purpose.
The sole purpose. He said, sobriety through the practice and teaching of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is the sole purpose of an AA group. The only purpose, not one of the purposes or a possible purpose, it is the sole purpose. Bill Wilson said that. I didn't. And so I say today, is our group practicing and teaching of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous from the book called Alcoholics Anonymous? And if we are, then we're doing the intent of what Bill intended for a group to be. And the recovery, I'm sure, because I've observed this in my own home group and many others, that the recovery rate seems to be better. And it seems to me that those people really practice the principles in this book called Alcoholics Anonymous.
I always like to stop and think a little bit about how we got away from that program, that original program in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when the book was published and began to go out across the United States, the first person that sobered up down here got a copy of the book, read it, studied it, did what it said, recovered from alcoholism, and started an AA group. First one in Arkansas did the same thing. First one in Oklahoma, the first one in California, the first one in Texas. The growth of the fellowship really began to come from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. But as the fellowship got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, they began to notice something that the first 100 didn't have. They began to notice the great strength and the great power that comes from large numbers of people sharing together who have solved a common problem. The first 100 didn't have that. They were only in about 3 little groups up there. They couldn't go to 90 meetings in 90 days because, hell, they didn't have 90 meetings, period. So they depended upon the spiritual experience, the finding of the power greater than human power in order to recover. But as the fellowship got bigger and bigger and bigger, they began to experience the power that comes from fellowship. They begin to question the severity of the program in the book. And they begin to say such things as, do you think it's really necessary that we do all that that program has to say? Is it really necessary to turn all of our will and life over to care of God as we understand Him? Couldn't we give Him the alcohol and keep the rest? They begin to talk about sharing all your life story with another human being. Couldn't we just share those parts that deal with alcohol and then forget the rest? After all, God already knows about it anyhow. They began to talk about getting rid of all their character defects. They said, hell, man, we're not going to have any personality left if we get rid of all of our character defects. Do you mean we have to make amends to all those people? And they began to say, well, maybe we don't have to be quite that severe. Maybe we could treat it like a cafeteria. Maybe we could take what we want and leave what we want and everything would be okay. Then came the great, great advent of the treatment centers. Please don't get us wrong. We got nothing against treatment centers. They serve a very valuable purpose under certain circumstances. So we got nothing against them. But in the treatment centers, especially where you charge people money for treatment, you got to have something more than just a simple little program that's already outlined in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. So you have to start bringing in some professional people. And as professional people started entering the field, then you begin to hear new terminology coming in dealing with alcoholics. You begin to hear these things such as chemical dependency. You begin to hear such things as dual dependency. I heard one the other day, it was called polydependency. I had one named Polly I depended on for years. You begin to hear terms like meaningful relationships, significant others. dysfunctional sex. And naturally, the people that came from the treatment centers came into AA, and they brought the terminology into AA, and I don't blame them. That's the only thing that they knew to bring. And they brought it into AA, and gradually, the language of AA began to change. And it got to the point, and it's still to that point in many cases, where you go to an AA meeting, and if they didn't read the preamble before the meeting, you wouldn't know what kind of meeting you're in. Because they talk about everything except alcoholism and recovery therefrom. So what we're going to be talking about this weekend is not the program in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to be talking about the program in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And we talk about the program in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, we're going to be talking about what the first 100 original people in AA found it necessary to do, the information they had to learn in order to recover from alcoholism. Joe?
Are we going to preach any more this weekend, Charlie?
Nope, no more preaching.
No more preaching. I hope you don't believe that.
Don't y'all believe that. Okay, now that we know those three things, and then Joe said it's the simple process of the 12 steps. These three basic ideas. Number one, the problem, which came from self-worth. Number two, the solution to the problem. It came from Carl Jung, who gave it to Roland, who gave it to Ebby, who brought it to Bill. And the program of the Oxford Group, also brought by Ebby to Bill. See, Bill's mind was a vessel. Bill didn't come up with any of these ideas. He gathered these ideas from other people, but he was the first man to know all three and to put them together in a program of recovery. So we go back to the table of contents of the book. And the book is laid out to present the program as they, it's perfectly written. The book is laid out to give the sequence of these things and say it is a program. And we use those words very lightly nowadays. But what is a program? A program is a sequence of ideas that lead to a conclusion. That's what a program is. And this is a sequence of ideas that lead to conclusion of recovery. Now, as we...
In your handout sheets, what you got when you checked in... There's a series of pictures in here, and any time we have one on the screen, you'll have one there right in front of you. So if you're way back in the back, can't see the screen too good, you've got a copy of it in your handout sheets. Right. First one is the big book goals.
The goals of the book. Now, this is one of the key things in studying the book in my early days. It gave me some idea of what the book was all about. And quite honestly, he doesn't say goals in the book, but he says purposes, certain purposes, same thing. And the first goal, the first purpose of the book is to show you what your problem is. And that's going to be the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. That's the section of the textbook that will show you what the problem is. Step one. Step one is a problem statement, the statement of the problem. The problem is you pause over alcohol, our lives have become unmanageable. That's a statement of the problem. We'll find that information in the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. That's the foundation of the book. And once we see the problem, then we see the solution. And that's in the chapter, there is a solution, more about alcoholism, and we agnostics. Those three chapters will give us all information we need on the solution to the problem. Power greater than ourselves.
Step two.
And then the last three chapters, how it works, interaction, working with others, those chapters contain the program of recovery and the basic recovery steps, steps 3 through 12. There's a practical program of action that was developed out of the Oxford Group steps. So we have three things. What is the problem? What is the solution to the problem, and how do you find that solution? A sequence of ideas that have to be attained in a certain sequence. If you don't have the problem, you can't find the solution. If you don't have the solution, you can't know the problem of action to find it. So the book is going to be laid out on three things. What is the problem? Step one. What is the solution? Step two. How do you find that solution? Steps 3 through 12.
You know, I think if you will get the layout of this book and the table of contents and understand that this book is written in certain sequences to bring about certain ideas.
Okay, right.
One chapter leads to the next, that leads to the next, that leads to the next. Each paragraph leads to the next and leads to the next. And leads. Each statement, each line leads to the next and leads to the next. All a series of ideas to bring about certain conclusions. See, I mean, I was in the printing business before I sold the business, but I printed books like this. And I've said on many books, many, many discussions of how to lay out a book. And I know a little bit about the nomenclature of a book. But when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I must have had more brain damage than I thought. Because it never dawned on me that this book was laid out in the same way. It just never came to my attention. I jumped around all over the place from one chapter to the next, never finding a place to start or anything. I was scatterbrained, you see. And when we first talked about this book being laid out in a certain sequence to bring about certain ideas, well, I understood that immediately, because that's what a textbook is. It teaches us that way. And also, Charlie would elaborate on this a little more, but I look at this book as a way that, pretty much the way Bill got sober. Remember his experience? 3 times he was in the town's hospital. 3 different times the only contact he had with anyone was Dr. Silkworth, who talked to him about his opinion, on 3 different occasions. So Bill's own experience was that he got the doctor's opinion information first. He learned from working with Dr. Bob that sharing of your experience with another alcoholic and him identifying with you was very, very important to identifying what your problem is. So he gives us chapter one, Bill's story. And then Abby brought Bill a solution. He's going to bring us a solution in chapter two. Abby presented Bill with a solution, and Bill did not like this solution at all. Remember, he was aghast. He was aghast. He rejected that idea. So he helps us a little bit. He tells us a little bit more about alcoholism, more about what's going to happen to us unless we accept this solution. Well, then he knew that we were going to have the same trouble with this God idea that he did. He remembered, he said, "My mind snapped shut against such series. I closed my mind on this idea about God." We agnostics. So he wrote a chapter there for us, and we're going to have the same problem he did, called We Agnostics. And agnostic means what? Gnostic means knowledge. You put the ag in front of it, without. Those of us who are without knowledge. Or the knowledge that I had was that of a 7-year-old boy. And I had rejected that a long time ago. So he helps us with this God idea. And then he's going to tell us how it works, how the program works. And then he's going to tells us what to do, into action. That's not into thinking, it's into action. The actions that we take bring about a certain result. And when we have those results, and then we can take this information that we have gained and the experience that we have had, and we can present this to another human being who is powerless over, who is an alcoholic, and who is powerless over alcohol just like we were. And we can help them where others can't.
Charlie? I don't think I would try to elaborate on that at all. I think that's great. Good information. You know, when you really start looking at this book as a book written in a certain sequence to convey these ideas in that sequence, then it becomes a fascinating book. Always before, when I read it, I'd read a little bit in how it works, and I didn't like what that had to say. I'd go back and read a little bit in chapter 2, there is a solution, I sure as hell didn't like that. I read some of the stories in the back, and I thought, well, they're just poor people, they don't know any better anyhow. And I read it like a novel. But when we finally begin to see that this thing is not a novel, that it's written in a certain sequence to convey these ideas in the same sequence that Bill had to know them in order to recover. Same sequence that Dr. Bob had to know them. See, he knew the solution. He knew the program of action. He didn't know what's wrong with him. So he didn't recover until he got that information. Then they took it to Bill Dodson. and they presented it to Bill Dodson in that sequence. What is the problem? What is the solution? What is the program of action? And Bill Dodson recovered, and I'll bet you that Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson looked at each other and said, by golly, this thing really works, doesn't it? It really does work. And they presented it to alcoholic after alcoholic after alcoholic when they wrote the book. All they did is take what they had been doing, the information they had been using, in the sequence that they had been presenting it, and put it down in a written form. And those of us that want to recover from alcoholism today, if we follow the same sequence, the same procedure, we're going to get the same results they did, recovery from alcoholism. And the book becomes fascinating when you see that. When you see how one chapter ties to the next chapter, to the next chapter, to the next chapter, how one paragraph ties to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, then it becomes a very, very interesting book. It's no longer a novel then. If the problem is powerless, then obviously the answer is going to lie within power. And if you know you're powerless, and if you know you need the power, then the only other thing you need to know is how do I find that power? And that's exactly what this book does. Now, carrying that idea in mind, let's go over to the preface for just a moment on Roman numeral 11. Second paragraph. Because this book has become the basic text for our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume, describing the AA recovery program, has been left untouched in the course of revisions made for both the second and the third editions. We're getting ready to come out with a fourth edition. And that portion of the book will be left untouched again in the fourth edition. I think I see two ideas here we need to talk about. First, because this book has become the basic text for our society. And I read that the words basic text, that kind of reminds me of a textbook in school. And you know, a lot of us in school, we didn't like textbooks because that meant you had to read and you had to study and take tests and et cetera. And we didn't particularly like the idea of a textbook.
Reminded me to cheat textbook.
But a textbook is simply a tool that is used to transfer information from the mind of one human being or a group of human beings to the mind of another human being, thereby increasing the knowledge of the one who's using the textbook. A textbook is usually written in a certain sequence. It normally starts at a very simple level. Then as the knowledge of the reader, the user of the book, increases, the information presented becomes more difficult. Let's take a textbook on mathematics. Let's say my friend Joe here, this Joe on this side, knows nothing at all about mathematics. He can't add, he can't subtract, he can't do any of that stuff. And I take him a textbook on mathematics and I say, Joe, I want you to go to chapter 5 and I want you to work those algebra problems. Well, being a good fellow, he would go to chapter 5 and look at the algebra problems, but hell, he can't even add and subtract. It's just a bunch of marks on paper to him and he couldn't do it. But if I took the book to him and I said, Joe, the first chapter in this book deals with the value of numbers, addition and subtraction. If you'll read it and study it and let me help you when you need help, by the time you're through with chapter 1, you'll know how to add and subtract. And sure enough, he does that. And then I say, now that you know how to add and subtract, you can go to the next chapter and learn how to multiply and divide. And he does that. And then I say, now you can go to the next chapter and you can learn fractions, decimals, and all that kind of stuff. And we gradually prepare his mind for the algebra problems in chapter 5. He can't add and subtract, he can count. In fact, he can count to 20 if he's standing there naked and got everything where it belongs, he says.
Well, you two can count to 21. I have to count to 20 and a half.
I think the greatest mistake being made in AA today is a newcomer comes to the door, an older member hands him the big book, and he says, go to chapter 5 and do what it says. The newcomer goes to chapter 5, and he reads a whole series of algebra problems. Step one said, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, our lives had become unmanageable. The newcomer said, man, I ain't powerless over nothing. Step two says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. The newcomer says, don't tell me I'm insane. Yeah, I do some stupid stuff when I'm drunk, but when I'm sober, I'm much like other people. Step three says, made a decision, turn our will and our life over to the care of God as you understand him. Well, if you're not powerless and you're not nuts, then you don't need to be worrying about a God that you don't understand in the first place. And if we do nothing else all weekend, I hope we can see the value of the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters, how they tie it together in perfect sequence to prepare our minds for chapter 5. You see, chapter 5 starts with step 3. And it's hard to start with step 3 unless you got 1 and 2 behind you. And that's what the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters do. A actual textbook. The other thing that's so important is there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Now, we've changed stories in the back of the book when we went from the first edition to the second edition in 1955. We again changed stories when we went from the second edition to the third edition in 1976. This year we're going to change some stories when we go to the third to the fourth edition. But the actual recovery program has been left untouched since I first appeared to the world in 1939 in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that's the greatest miracle in AA today. You know how we love to change things. And everybody that's ever read this book has rewritten it in their mind at least two or three times. But collectively, we've never found it necessary to change our recovery program. I wonder why.
It works.
Very simple, isn't it? It works, doesn't it? It works just as good today as it did back in 1939. You see, alcoholics haven't changed. They're still getting drunk. They still get in hospitals, jailhouses, divorce courts, car wrecks, cemeteries, and everywhere else. All the fun things we've always done. Alcohol hasn't changed. It's exactly the same as it used to be. They've changed the names of it. They've changed the colors of it. Human nature hasn't changed. It's the same as it was 2,000 years ago. So if alcoholics and alcohol and human nature hasn't changed, then there's been no necessity to change the program of recovery from that condition known as alcoholism. I think that's important we understand that. I think it's important that we explain that to the newcomer. Yeah, this is 2001. The big book was written in 1939. But as far as alcoholism is concerned, nothing has changed, and therefore recovery hasn't changed either, Joe.
Okay. Well, to the first edition. Live with Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show the alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Again, he talks about the purposes. But then we hope these pages will prove so convincing we need no further authentication will be necessary. So, he's talking about the ones that present, we are more than 100, these were the people that wrote the book, 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless mind and body. So this book is not a single author, although Bill did write the book, it's the message of the first 100 people that he's writing on. So it's not that you know, we see a book that was wrote by one author, authored by one person. We can object to this, but 100 people is a lot of evidence to go against. 100 people who have recovered from the same thing that's killing us. That should impress the reader.
The first 40 people, and that's what they had approximately when they started writing the book. They made the decision to write this thing. They said, Bill, we want you to write the book. You know more about it than anybody else. You've been sober longer than anybody else, and that time just a little over 3 years. But they said, this is not to be your book, it's to be our book. And as you write it, we want to see each chapter. And we'll review it, and we'll add to, we'll delete from, we'll change around anything that we find necessary. When we're through with it, it'll be the collective knowledge, experience, and wisdom of all 40 of us. And by the time the book was published, there was 100 of them. So I must remind myself as I read the book today. I'm not reading a one-person, one-author book. Awful easy for me to argue with one person. I read a book that's been authored by one person. I see something there I don't agree with. I say, well, who in the hell is he to think he's smarter than I am? But if I do that with a big book, I've got to realize I'm arguing not only with one, I'm arguing with 100 people. I'm arguing with 100 people who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I find it's a lot easier to argue with one than that 100 who have recovered from the same thing that's killing me as a practicing alcoholic.
And it says to show other alcoholics, that's us, precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Now, this book is not to tell us just about how to recover, because later on in our book it says that we talk about specifically, exactly, with clear-cut directions. So this is a book that's going to tell us precisely, specifically, exactly, with clear-cut directions on how to recover from alcoholism. And if I want to recover from alcoholism, guess what? I really need to do precisely, specifically, exactly, following the clear-cut directions as best I can, or I might not recover. So that's what I'm. That's the main purpose of this book. And later on down there, it says many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And I don't know about you, but I know about me. When I first come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I stood in the back of the rooms, and I looked down at my feet, and I was ashamed. I was ashamed of what I had become, because I knew what an alcoholic was. I grew up around them. They were no good, rotten SOBs is what they were. Terrible people. And I became just like them. And I told myself I'm a no good, rotten SOB. I had no comprehension that I might be a very sick person. Did not have any idea. So I stood in the back of the rooms and ashamed. Finally, thank God, 1974, we were in a hotel room. Joe and Charlie and Tony and George and I were sitting here talking about the doctor's opinion. And they said that it wasn't sin. It wasn't moral character. It was an actual illness called alcoholism. You know, and I said, well, if it's not sin, it's not moral character, then what in the hell is it? Because I need to know. I'm dying here. You see, and I know today that those feelings of guilt, shame, and remorse and being a no-good, rotten SOB drives most drunks back out there to drink. Because I can only stay miserably dry so long. Then I've got to have some relief. And this information about the doctor's opinion, which we're going to talk about now, I believe, is very, very helpful to me. As a matter of fact, in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the first 16 printings of that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the doctor's opinion was on page 1. 1955, and we don't know why they moved the doctor's opinion back into the Roman numeral sections. We don't know why. But what happened after that was that people come into Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't read the Roman numeral sections, do we? So we disregard that information, and we say the first 164 pages are the most important part of this book. I say the first 173 pages, which includes the doctor's opinion, is the most important part of this book. Because as I see it today, the rest of this book is going to tell me how to recover from the condition of the body and mind that Dr. Silkworth explains. And I need to know that information. I need to know precisely, specifically, and exactly what alcoholism is. It's not moral character. It's not sin. You see, it's not that I'm a no-good, rotten SOB. I am some of those things, no doubt. But primarily, I have an illness called alcoholism, a physical allergy and obsession of the mind. Thank God for that information.
To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And if you'll notice, the words precisely how we have recovered, those words are in italics.
Charlie calls them squiggly writing, but they're really italic.
I call it squiggly writing. And when you see squiggly writing in the big book, it's usually something very, very important. It simply means pay special attention to this because we're trying to get a point across here. Now, the other thing we need to look at is precisely how we have recovered. And you hear arguments in AA going on day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. Can you recover from alcoholism? Some people say you can, some say you can't. Well, I hope we can, because if we can't recover from that, we're going to be in a hell of a mess, aren't we? You know, I'm not cured of alcoholism. I will always have the physical allergy to alcohol. But prior to coming to AA, not only did I have the physical allergy, I couldn't drink without getting drunk. I also had an obsession of the mind, and I couldn't stay sober. And because of the obsession of the mind and because of the physical allergy, my life became absolutely living hell, a hopeless condition of mind and body. I came to AA. I got sober, and I began to work the program. Now, I still can't successfully drink alcohol. I've still got the physical allergy, but I no longer have the obsession of the mind. Therefore, I do not live in that hopeless condition of mind and body. I have recovered from that condition. I will always be alcoholic, but I've recovered from alcoholism. And that's what our book is trying to say, and it's going to say it all the way through this book. Recovered, recovering, and etc. from the hopeless condition of mind and body known as alcoholism.